what's more hurtful to the movement is somebody saying the solution is let's just not put Lucian in there. Let's just put somebody else in there because they're of color, and we solved it, right?
Yes.
You got to unpack, and the unpacking of it is, well, why is it that there's only these, to your point, white executives that are at the very tops of these companies, you know, on down to, hey, our internship program's not right.
Right, because you don't want to just put a Band-Aid on this bullet wound.
Exactly.
And by just replacing it, it's like, all right, Lucian, sorry, you're gone. We're putting in some black person just so we can, like, check this off. Mm-hmm. And then the systemic issues are still maintained throughout the entire ecosystem of the company. This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features. Annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com. What's going on? Welcome to The New Music Business. I'm your host, Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business, the book. Today, we are rerunning an episode. This is the first time we've ever done this. An episode that initially premiered last July with the artist manager, Jonathan Azu. This is in honor of Black History Month this month because Jonathan and I, we had a really illuminating conversation about how to repair racial inequities in the music industry and the history of how our industry at the executive level is so white. Specifically in the Billboard Power 100, the top 50 people, there's only one black person in that in the executive level. And Jonathan has some ideas as to why and how we can help repair those disparities. Now, Jonathan is also a member of the Black Music Action Coalition, which I spoke about last week a little bit with Dina LaPolt. And Jonathan also recently launched the Diversity in Music. That's diversityinmusic.org and is the first ever employment talent directory for underrepresented women and minorities in music. So go on over to diversityinmusic.org, check out his new organization. And I hope you enjoy this podcast, which we recorded last June following the George Floyd protests and premiered this episode this past July. As always, please like, subscribe, find us wherever you are listening to this and hit that subscribe button. Follow us however you're doing it. Just pause this episode, subscribe. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, it'd be awesome if you left a 5-star review. Those really help. If you're listening on YouTube, leave a review. Head on over to ariestake.com, sign up for that email list. That's how you'll be informed by everything we do. And of course, find me on Instagram and Twitter at Ari Herstand. You can find all of us at Ari's Take on Twitter, Instagram, and now TikTok. So head on over and follow us all those places. All right, let's kick into the show with Jonathan Azu. Azu, thank you for having me at your beautiful backyard, your house. This is the first episode that I've done in person with somebody since quarantine started. I've been doing a lot of the Zoom, so this feels nice to kind of be in the flash right now.
It's like in 3D.
Right. In 3D. It's kind of weird seeing people below the waist. I'm pretty sure that everyone is just in their boxers when I'm talking to them.
I'm actually a hologram.
Right. Exactly. Much safer right now. So we measured it. We're 6 feet apart. No, this is cool. So, you know, we're in a really challenging, crazy, interesting time right now in the music industry. And I mean, with the quarantine, we don't know how long the live music industry is going to be shut down. I'm curious just how you've been doing this whole time, how your artists are doing, how you're doing with all touring shut down indefinitely. Like, what is your day-to-day looking like these days?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like everybody, we're figuring it out by the day, right? And I think, you know, it's been interesting because I had artists in Asia just as it was starting to break over there.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Okay.
Corey Henry was over there and Emily King was scheduled to go over there. Mm-hmm. So we were watching this thing from a distance.
Yeah.
I think we all were watching it. Right. It wasn't that much of a surprise.
But yeah.
We were monitoring it and really it was just there was just so much, I'll call it misinformation, but different perspectives on what was happening.
Right.
And I'm much more pragmatic. I'm much more, I have medical people in my family, so I was asking a lot of questions, and there were some people in our sandbox of the artists that were like, you know, it's fake news, it's this, that, right? So it was just like, who do you believe? And then ultimately, the artist is the person at risk, right? They're the ones that actually are going onto a stage, doing meet and greets, traveling in the airport, right? You know, so sometimes as team members, it's easy to look at that and be like, hey, it's all good, go do the show, and you know, but you're sleeping at home that night, and the artist is out there. You know, carrying the weight. So, but we were lucky enough as a company to get a lot done in the first 3 months of the year.
Okay.
We had a really good first 3 months with the group Grammy nominations.
That's right.
And we developed a partnership with InGrooves and Universal Music Group to set up our own label system.
Nice.
We successfully put Luke James' album out. We toured that. He sold out all his dates. Emily sold out all her dates. We were going back for more.
Yeah.
We were setting up tours for this year with Corey Henry. Was going to do an arena tour with Lenny Kravitz.
Wow.
Right?
Okay.
He's supposed to be in Europe doing arenas now.
That's rough.
You know, Michelle Williams was gonna be doing a tour as well.
Yeah.
And you know, those both went away. So it's really been, you know, for a good 30 days, it was like, all right, this is happening.
Yeah.
What are we taking down?
Yeah. Yeah.
How are we taking those down?
Yeah.
What are we trying to shift?
Mm-hmm.
And if we're shifting them, where are they shifting to?
Yeah.
Where do we want to plant? I talk about planting a flagpole.
Mm.
And I felt like we could maybe reschedule some stuff for November, December.
Looking
this
unlikely
year.
Right now.
March.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it looks challenging.
Right.
Without it being Swiss cheese of a tour. Right.
Yeah, right,
I think we will have potentially some markets that will be like, hey, we're good. We're doing mitigation, taking practices within our venues, but we're good to do shows.
Yeah.
In some capacity, right?
Yeah.
But routing a tour,
right?
Difficult.
Well, I mean, even right now, it's a state-by-state thing.
Exactly.
I mean, they just had that show. Chase Rice did a show outside of Nashville like 2 weeks ago with 1,000 people in the venue, no social distancing, no masks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, I don't know many artists that would feel comfortable doing that. I sure wouldn't feel comfortable attending a show or doing that. And I would imagine most of your artists probably wouldn't feel comfortable in the immediate future doing shows like that.
It's interesting. A lot of people talk about herd immunity.
Right.
Yeah. It's really, we should also be talking about herd mentality.
Because
ultimately, we can talk about what should happen at these shows to protect people from a public health standpoint.
Yeah.
But the public has to decide they actually want to do those things.
Right. So even if they do open back up, are people going to feel comfortable going? I mean, it's not even like if it's legally they can do it.
Correct.
It's who's going to feel comfortable. I mean, I've been talking to venue owners and they're thinking, you know, they're going to be at half capacity even when everything is back up and running. Even when there's a vaccine, it's just, are people going to feel comfortable going out to live music? I mean, the concert industry is like probably going to be one of the hardest hit industries just across the board because that's gathering a lot of people in a small space. And so even when, let's say, that, you know, everyone is vaccinated, people are still going to be a little bit skittish. And who knows what venues are going to even have survived this.
Yeah,
so
it's going to be tough. So we, you know, we worked hard to sort through what was happening. We worked hard to reshuffle things and plant flags in the ground of when we thought things would come back, and then really start to get a digital mindset of how can we engage with our consumers, with our fans, during this bridge period, however long this bridge is to the other side. But we have to engage with our fans and set up ways in which we can touch them and they can hear music and really feel part of what, and it, you know, the one silver line is we're all going through it.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly. We're all figuring it out. I mean, and that's the thing, is just like everyone is, you know, struggling through this moment and just figuring out what steps to take. What were those conversations like with Corey, who's about to go on a big tour, arena tour with Lenny Kravitz, and he's such a live artist. Like, how is it with him not being able to perform? I mean, what's an average year that Corey does in terms of number of dates? Like 150?
Something no, it's like? 150, but it's a lot.
Okay. Yeah.
It's global. I mean, this year alone, Corey, in 2020, we would have, I can't remember how many countries, but it was, you know, Korea, Japan, Israel, all over Europe.
Yeah.
You know, South America.
And that's his largest revenue generator, I would imagine.
It's outside the U.S. And we do a lot of work in the U.S., but outside the U.S. So it's you know, if I was to look at this, I think the international artists that have international presence and do international business will have an opportunity to get things back on from a touring perspective before U.S. artists.
Right.
The U.S. is not, I mean, let's just all be honest with each other. Right. We're not handling this
well.
We're not
doing a good job right now. No, we're the number one.
Well.
Yeah, yeah.
At,
no.
At all. No. No indications.
No.
In the last 2 weeks, my mindset has shifted to, honestly, I think it's June next year before
U.S. will start to open back up for shows.
In any sort of way.
Yeah.
You know? I just don't know how it happens before then. Just knowing all the things that have to take place from a public health standpoint.
Right.
For you know, venue owners, I think I'm not a venue owner, but to feel comfortable doing it. So we'll see what plays out, right? Because even when a vaccine's found and therapeutics are found, there's a whole additional runway to getting those to marketplace.
Right.
And then, you know, reality of it is that, you know, there'll be a lot of people that, you pulled in with the Tesla today,
right.
which I love, right? You know, but there's a lot of people who are like, I'm not getting the version one of the Tesla.
Right.
It's
exactly.
Version one of the Tesla.
That is absolutely true. And I can tell firsthand experience, it is, as an early adopter of this new technology, you're feeling it out. You're not quite 100% right. of the time,
so,
which,
version one of the vaccine.
Yeah, version one of the vaccine. Who's going to line up for that?
Exactly. So who knows what's going to play out? But ultimately, I think internationally, we're seeing other countries. You know, we should, as an industry, look outside the U.S. and learn what's happening outside the U.S. and think about how we apply that.
Yeah.
The government should be doing that from a public health standpoint.
Right.
And we should be doing it as an industry. How is Japan going back up? How is Korea going back up?
Yeah.
We have in this country, sense of, so oftentimes a sense of global arrogance that we do things the best.
Right.
The most accurate.
Yeah.
And this is going to be one of those situations where other countries are and not even, you know, is going to be, it's happening now.
Right.
That are leading to recovery faster and better than we are. And we have to look to them. So I do think that, you know, possibly end of this year, you know, the possibility of sitting over in Japan, you know, for 14 days or 7 days quarantining and then doing a residency of shows could be possible.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We'll see. You know?
Sure. Yeah. Outside of the live space, what are your artists doing right now kind of at home? Is this a time to, is like writing this year or working on records or like, what are they doing?
It's a hybrid of things. I mean, yes, we're, you know, if you don't have a recording deal and you're working on one, we're working to close that. We've closed some publishing agreements with some artists. So artists are writing. We've opened up recording budgets for artists. Mm. So they're recording records. So everyone's definitely in a creative space. Zone, working really hard. We have some artists that are, you know, Corey Henry's been doing every Sunday, and this kind of happened organically, but over at Apogee Studios with Bob Clearmountain, the legendary Bob Clearmountain, mixing a live session every Sunday.
Oh, wow.
You know, at 3 o'clock, and it's broadcasted across all platforms.
Oh, cool.
And so we've been doing that with Corey.
Nice.
We've been fulfilling some of our obligations that we had. You know, Emily was scheduled to do TED Talk in the TED conference in Vancouver, their annual event. They did do it. They did it virtually.
Huh.
You know, so we've been executing some things that we had committed to where we can.
Yeah.
You know, talking a lot about when things come back on board, how are we positioning ourselves, looking at product.
Okay. Like merch.
Going into the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
Stores.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Instead of just selling merch on our website, are we becoming actually a merch store, like thinking about it like seasonal, like we are dropping the winter line of
fashion brand, like,
exactly
that kind of thing.
Thinking how do we engage with our fans in different ways and more interesting ways, because I do believe the artists that do that, the artists that put content out that really figure this thing out on how to engage with fans, those fans will of course be the first ones to buy tickets when it comes back on board.
Right. To keep that engagement up throughout this whole time period. Yeah. I mean, instead of just disappearing and going into hibernation or something like that. So that's nice. I mean, you know, I think about, it's almost like it's in some twisted way, it's like a blessing that this is happening now versus 10, 15, 20 years ago, where we didn't have the internet or social media or ways to kind of, you know, digitize our business in any form. And so now we're forced to get much more creative with our business to just keep a business rolling in some respect. But at the same time, even with just fan engagement, there's all these tools that we have now that, that people can
You're
do
absolutely
that.
Right. Yeah. The dealing with this now versus dealing with this in 1990
right.
would be far more difficult. Right.
Right.
Just,
right.
just even things such as fulfilling a merch item. Right?
Yeah. Right. You know? Ordering the merch item.
Ordering
right.
the merch item. Right. You know, yeah. imagine if we were all just purely dependent upon, you know, you can only buy merchandise by going to a show. You can't do it online.
Right.
You know, because the bar of entry of selling online is too high. It's too expensive. There's too many hurdles to go over. So we are positioned as a society to win here, to continue to win or figure it out. Mm-hmm. Right. But, you know, it still makes it challenging.
Have any of your artists been experimenting with live streaming or live stream shows or anything like that?
Well, Corey's doing the weekly. We're not charging
for the Clear Mountain thing.
Yeah. We're broadcasting it out. We have a tip jar type thing because some people said they wanted to contribute, which is great.
Yeah.
You know, my attitude on that, it makes sense. And I think last time we talked, I talked about regular season and Super Bowls.
Yep.
It's like an analogy that I use that you want to have Super Bowl moments in your career, but you want a lot of regular season stuff. And I think that applies towards webcasting, that you should be putting content out and distributing it across platforms, and you should be allowing your fans to access it any way in which way they can.
Mm-hmm.
And then you should create some Super Bowl moments where you're like, hey, this is a paid experience. Here's what the experience is going to be. We're covering an album, or we're going to be collaborating with another artist, or we're going to be bringing the full band back together to do the set. And yes, there's going to be a transaction for you to have access to this content.
So these are like previews, like these free little glimpses of kind of the live stream. And then the Super Bowl moment is the full concert that's ticketed, that kind of a thing?
Type thing.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if you ticket everything,
you're
limiting the fan that just wants to engage.
Sure. So that makes sense. It's kind of the... These are the engagement tools that you're using in this new creative way that kind of feeds them.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you do put up that high ticket item, they've felt taken care of this entire time that they're willing to jump in with that.
Exactly.
So do you have the high ticket items, those big Super Bowl moments in the live streaming realm that you're kind of
we're working on it.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
And I also strategically thought that what you would see in this kind of bell curve is you would see a few people doing streams in the very in March
right.
April, when this hit.
Yes.
And you're going to see a ton where people are just going to be like, I don't even know. Like, I remember going to Instagram about five or six weeks ago. And it was like all lives.
Right.
It was insane.
Everyone
it's like, what
live.
Do you do with this?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And then you'll hit the other end of the bell curve where that will go away and then it'll be, you know, premium content.
Mm.
I think that's how that works.
Technology is catching up to that right now too. Is like, I think when this hit, there really weren't that many live streaming options that were ticketed that where the technology met the moment. I mean, one of the very the only real ticketed live streaming platforms that existed was Stage It, which came out 10 years ago, and it was still using the flash technology, and it just like was not really a solution that kind of met the expectations of 2020. But now I've started to see a lot more live streaming platforms that are kind of meeting the moment, that really went into overdrive to try to, you know, just be that platform to meet the needs of all the artists out there that want to do this. So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we'll see. So I want to back up a little bit, and talk about Culture Collective. So you had been at, Red Light Management for how many years? Many years.
Many years.
I was in New York.
I was in New York. So my career path was, I spent a few years at CBS Radio corporately in New York.
Okay.
Working on John Sykes' team. I was that's when I initially joined. I just graduated from college.
Okay.
Right?
So okay.
And I worked for CBS Radio. John Sykes was running it, and he'd hired a lot of his former MTV Networks friends to come through and help run radio.
Okay.
So it was Andy Schoen, Greg Drebin, David Goodman, who's, you know, actually who initially hired me out of St. Louis, where I was living with my parents, to come to New York. So I credit David Goodman a lot with, you know, getting me where I'm at.
Yeah.
And I was there handling music partnerships. So I was the liaison between the label community and our 80 program directors of radio stations across the U.S. So we were developing programs that were being promoted through our radio stations, but they were music programs.
Okay.
And they were sold to advertisers.
Okay.
So I built all these relationships with program directors, and I built all these relationships with label executives.
Yeah.
And this was in the 2000s, and, you know, managers were always very important in the sandbox of the artist, but ultimately then the labels were much more in the driver's seat.
Yep.
And I left CBS and I went into live events. I joined Superfly Presents. Yeah.
Cool.
You know, there was, I mean, there was probably only 10 of us working there at the time.
Yeah.
And it's smart, like a startup office in on West 3rd and LaGuardia Place.
All right.
You know, near NYU.
Yeah.
And at that time it was just Bonnaroo. And we went on to create other festivals outside lands.
Cool. Yeah.
Googa Mooga, which was a food experience in Prospect Park. We partnered with the Life is Good Company.
Oh, yeah.
And partnered, and we did the Life is Good Family Festival, which was really cool because it was for all ages.
Where was that?
That was in Boston,
okay.
Which is where Life is Good started.
Cool.
And we developed the marketing group, which is huge business for them today. Mm-hmm. So it was all about how do we leverage the relationships we have with advertisers that are coming to life at our festivals.
Yeah.
If we can sell solutions to them around the Super Bowl, we can figure out how to sell solutions in the regular season to them. So it was, hey, State Farm, it's great that you're sponsoring Bonnaroo, but let's talk about how we can create other cool things for you as an agency. So we started the agency and had amazing years there.
Yeah.
Still very close with everybody at Superfly.
Cool.
Corin Capshaw, who is founder of Red Light. Was an investor in some of the assets that Superfly co-owned.
Oh, that's right. And isn't Red Light a co-owner in Bonnaroo?
Well,
Corin
was an investor in Bonnaroo.
Got it.
And he also does a lot of investments, you know.
Okay, sure.
And Superfly and Corin co-owned assets together.
Gotcha. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I got to know Corin really well around that relationship. And more interesting was that when I was in college, I booked Dave Matthews, you know, so it was kind of like a full circle moment. Like,
where did you go to school?
Drake University.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so it was
in Iowa?
In Des Moines, yeah, where the Iowa caucuses are held.
Yeah. I played Drake University. It was probably not the level that Dave Matthews was playing Drake. I was at a little, I played it was in the student union. It was one of those that was like the singer songwriter that they would bring in for, you know, like a coffee house series or whatever.
Yeah, that's how I got started. That's when I was in college. I was the guy that.
Oh, you were bringing the music.
I was bringing the music.
Right.
So, you know, Corin was looking for a general manager to come over to Red Light, and at that time, I think we were around 100 artists and a handful of offices. So I left Superfly and became GM of Red Light, and was at Red Light for a bunch of years. While I was there, I had signed some artists, but you know, really was there primarily as general manager. And I was kind of like, I was kind of an advocate, if you will, for the managers while I was there, you know, and really working with them and helping to provide them with tools and resources and relationships and networking to help them in their everyday management of their artists.
And this was the New York office?
I was operating out of the New York office, but I was GM of the company.
Gotcha. So at that time, there was New York, LA, Charlottesville.
Charlottesville was the
Seattle?
First office.
Or no, that
at that time when I joined, it was Charlottesville, which was the first office.
Yep.
New York, which was the second office.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was LA.
Yeah.
And then Nashville. So I was there when there was four.
Okay.
I think today it's Seattle and London.
Yeah.
Is on that. We rolled London in when I was there.
Gotcha.
Right.
Cool. So so that was like mid 2000s or something.
Late 2000s.
Cool.
When I went over to I'm trying to think. It's like picking time.
Right.
Late 2000, early 2010 or something like that, right? And then, went over to Red Light, you know, signing some artists, but also there as GM, was in working out of New York in the same building that ATO Records is housed out of. So I built a really great relationship with the team at ATO.
Yeah.
You know, we did a lot of amazing things. I mean, it was really neat. I mean, probably one of the more memorable things working out of that office was the Alabama Shakes and the fact that management and label were in the same building. And I was there when they essentially had signed them and to watch the growth of that band.
Yeah.
It was just really neat to watch amongst a lot of other things. But that was a really fun one. And it still brings back good memories when I'm playing their albums at home, thinking, you know, some of the small, tiny shows they were doing back then at Mercury Lounge.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, for sure.
Right.
And then, I caught their Greek show. I want to say it was like probably 2016 or something. It was like right when they were, I think that was the year they were nominated for everything at the Grammys. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was like right before that or something like that. But, yeah, that's great. It's like that's a true kind of Red Light ATO collaboration. Mm-hmm. One of the ones that really popped.
Really
that was
popped, yeah. And then you throw in the Bonnaroo and the festivals. It all really, ecosystem of Red Light really, you saw it come together with that particular artist.
Yeah.
And, you know, I decided to move to L.A., with my family for personal reasons, but also, you know, I started seeing a lot of stuff shifting this way out west. And so we made the jump out here. I took a step out of the general manager role and started working with Red Light just around my clients and started thinking around, you know, just having a lot of self-reflection, you know, about my career and people I had met with and people that have been influential into where I'd gotten in my life. And, the fact that I was often the only person of color that was in a lot of these meetings in my career. I was the only person of color at a lot of these high level, you know, curated events where they're bringing in the president and CEO of this label and this and that. And you're sitting there and you're saying, what once used to be, I guess that's the way it is because I'm just living in it, was, I think I understand why it is. And now the question is, do I want to be an example of somebody that breaks that cycle and says, you know, you can be an owner of your own business and be of color. You can develop ways in which your company is structured to help break systemic issues that are out there that help that really prevent diversity and inclusion from happening in our industry. Not always intentional.
Sure.
Right. You know, and I think that's the one shift that we're seeing now versus before this year, was that, you know, not in a million years would I ever think that a lot of people I worked with would ever think that diversity and inclusion is not a good idea, or they wouldn't believe in the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
But what were they actively doing to themselves to help provide a better, you know, structure to prevent these things from happening?
Right.
And they also manifest themselves in different ways.
Sure.
The George Floyd killing was an acute manifestation of systematic racism that led in death, and it was very shocking for everyone to see. But you know, the manifestation of systematic racism comes to life in many, many other ways in society, and also many, many other ways within our industry, and many, many other ways within these companies in our industry that has pledged to get behind the movement have to look within. So I wanted to be a company. This was a year ago, March, that really embodied these values into our mission statement. And we launched, and that was part of my, you know, my story of when I launched. I was very public about it, and I wanted to walk in it. I wanted it to be me and my vision. And it's been interesting that literally a year later, almost to the date of launching, COVID hits. And then a few months later, the George Floyd killing happens. And then, then from there. And it's been interesting because it's just, I've been talking a lot about it. You know, not just publicly on platforms, but I've gotten calls from colleagues, at Red Light, CBS, Superfly, saying, you know, let me check in. I want to check in on myself as an individual.
Yeah.
So how can I do better? Because I know somebody
from white colleagues.
Correct.
Who are somebody
I worked with that I respect, I look up to.
Yeah.
And I know why you left Red Light. I know why you started Culture Collective, and I know what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
What can I do as an individual to be better and be more self-aware? And so it's been cathartic for me because I like to talk a lot about it, you know, because I think if we can have these conversations, even if they feel uncomfortable, it pushes you towards progress.
So what are some of the suggestions? So when these white colleagues call you and they're asking for guidance, or they're asking for to check in, or just to see how you're doing, but also how can we be better as an industry? What are some of your thoughts on that? And what do you kind of, talk to these colleagues about?
I think, you know, ultimately, I mean, it's a variety of things, but the first and foremost is recognition.
Sure.
Saying, all right, you know, I now recognize, and whatever that epiphany was, I now recognize that I need to do more as an individual in the self, this being self-aware of the shoes that you walk in as someone, not someone of color, versus somebody that is.
Yeah.
And that's the first step, ultimately. And the second step is recognizing that, you know, like it or not, right? You know, you're part of the problem.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's not always with intention part of the problem, right? It's sometimes not with intentions. It can be something as little as you know, hearing something and not saying something about it. Right. We're seeing that a lot. That's why social media is exploding.
Yes.
Because people of all races are saying, I'm not going to stand for what you just said to that patron over there.
Right.
And versus, that's not my fight.
Right. And I mean, it's that's part of the privilege that white people have, where we don't have to acknowledge it, and we can kind of operate in our own little bubble and just pretend that there isn't a problem because it doesn't directly inhibit our upward mobility, or you know, in a sense that's obvious, or it's not a problem that white people have to acknowledge on a daily basis, and so we can pretend it doesn't exist.
Correct.
And so I think that, you know, that's been something that I have been, you know, focusing on the last few months, is just trying to see how can I start with the acknowledgement, start with acknowledging white privilege, start acknowledging all of the privileges that I have as a white male in the industry and just in society, but then looking at like where's the best place to, like, what is the best role for someone, for any of us, and any of the to kind of have in this place? How do we effectively move not just the conversation forward, mm-hmm. but move the industry forward in a more equitable place? Mm-hmm. And like, I think we're all trying to figure that out right now.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think that our industry is you know, there's a term, progressive white privilege, that was brought to my attention relatively recent, right? Because I've always thought of it as white privilege. And,
yeah.
And progressive white privilege is that individual that, again, I think it's a lot in our industry, that would never, ever think that D&I is not a good idea, would never, ever think that the killing of George Floyd was justified,
mm-hmm.
Would never, you know, supports Black Lives Matter, puts the sign up in the window,
right.
Posts in solidarity,
right.
on Blackout Tuesday.
Right, right, right.
You know, encourage their company to take Juneteenth off.
Sure.
Right. But would never say that they're part of the issue, because they are in support of or don't believe in those things. Right. But there's a whole host of other things,
right.
that they may say, well, but yeah, you know, yeah, I'm trying to hire, a director, underneath me,
mm-hmm.
and you know, nobody of color applied. So, you know, I just kind of went with
right.
the person that I felt comfortable with.
Right. Right. Right.
It's this kind of like progressive of like, I'm progressive enough to know that those things that I mentioned before are not right or need to be fixed, because they're not acute and they're very public facing.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Ken and Karen stuff, right. on social media, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But when you start to unpack some of the other things,
mm-hmm.
they're not as willing to say that that's an issue.
So you're leading by example. You're running your own company. You know, it's you have I think it's an all black roster. And it's how would someone else in like your white colleagues that are in those positions of power kind of actually do the work and not just pay lip service to the movement?
You know, I'll give one that really stuck with me when I was starting my company.
Yeah.
Was that I think the companies I've worked for and other companies in the industry have always done a really great job of hiring interns.
Okay.
To that eventually become whatever, assistant.
Right. Yes.
Office coordinator, and then become manager or director, or right. There's a pipeline there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And, you know, I've always noticed that the diversification in the internship pool is always like, you know, wasn't great, right? You'd look at it and say, well, what's the deal here?
Mm-hmm.
And I started really unpacking the fact that we don't hire our interns.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, we don't pay our interns. Right? And if I'm, you know, economically challenged that I can't over the summer pay to fly someplace, New York or LA,
right.
put myself up and work for free, yeah. I can't. That's not an option, right? And the reality of it is that the overwhelming majority of those that are economically challenged are people of color.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So now that internship program is now going to go to most likely somebody not of color that's affluent, that can afford to do it.
Right, right.
There's your pipeline right there. And then you ask yourself, well, you know, we hire within, or we hire who's within arm's reach.
Right.
And they tend to not be diversified.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great real life example. And that makes a lot of sense. And you're part of so there's this organization that has started the Black Music Coalition. Mm-hmm. And it's Black artist managers that have kind of come together. What is this?
Yeah, so it was developed by Binta Brown, who's an attorney with a political background, but also uh-huh. works with artists.
Okay,
had put it together, and basically there was a Zoom call at some point in time with a bunch of managers, and we were discussing what can we do, and there's multiple missions or charges that the organization has.
Okay,
but one of the primary ones is holding these companies accountable. Mm. You know, so we all watched a lot of companies post on social media. You know, they cut a lot of checks.
Right.
A lot of checks flying around. Yes. Right. Okay. And then now it's where's the accountability?
Sure.
Because if these companies would have held themselves accountable, we wouldn't be where we're at.
Mm. Yes.
And since they're private, You can't self-police.
Right.
Right. And I'm just making this up, but if Company A says, hey, we're going to diversify our C-level executives, so going forward, our goal is to, you know, make sure that within 3 years, 20% of our executive, you know, C-level executives are people of color, mm-hmm. and they only get to 10%.
Mm.
What happens?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? So we're working to develop ways in which we can hold those companies accountable.
Okay.
To the best of our capabilities. And hopefully, also, too, sometimes it's not just us coming in and saying, hey, you know, show us what you're doing.
Yep.
It could be, here's who you should be working with to help you get there as a company. I do believe that the bigger the institution, well, all institutions, but definitely these big institutions, they need to be hiring outside, bringing consultants in to help really look at what they're doing, unpack that, restructure it, create safe environments for employees to talk about these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then really have that self-evaluation. You know? And then I also really think...
Real quick, I want to let you know about Too Lost. Too Lost is a new distribution company to the space, and let me tell you, I am very impressed with them. I got a full deep dive demo with the founder, and yeah, they're very innovative, and when you come into the distribution space at this stage with how crowded it is, you better be innovative, and they are. Yes, they will get your music out to Spotify, Apple Music, all the places, plus 450 other outlets around the world. They do not take a commission. This is why 300,000 artists and labels have already used them. They've already distributed 7 million songs. They offer payment splitting, and they don't charge your collaborators for this service for the payment splitting. They will just pay your collaborators directly for free. They have publishing administration with BMG, so you know it's legit. A lot of distributors have fallen into trouble with using some other less than legit pub admin services. Well, Too Lost is partnered with BMG. You know it's legit. They offer instant royalty advances. This is something that's very cool. And if you have historical streaming data and you need just a bulk payment up front, they can see how much your music has earned in the past. I'm like, all right, we think we know what you're going to earn in the next 3 years. Here's a check for $100,000 or whatever it will be. And you can just click a button and get that distributed and into your account immediately. They do lyrics and credits distribution for free. They have a very innovative analytics platform where, yes, you will see real-time analytics for Spotify, Apple Music, but also Pandora, Deezer, SoundCloud, and Peloton. They're the only ones that do Peloton. They also have a service where you can search the internet wherever your music is being used, and it will just show you a chart of everywhere, every TikTok video, everywhere, every YouTube video, everywhere your music is possibly being used. I've never seen this before. That was very cool. They'll register you with SoundExchange, and they have a fraud prevention tool, and they're doing fraud prevention. So if you're worried about your music, you know, getting a bot attack or something like that and getting ripped down, which we've seen is a big issue. They have fraud prevention tools that are better than most other distributors that I have seen. Check out Too Lost. You can just go to toolost.com, use the promo code Ari's Take for 3 months free and try them out. Let them know what you think.
Compensation should be tied to this.
in
some
way?
Form or fashion. I have trouble really. If you're 65 years old and you're a chairman or chairperson of a company,
yep.
right, and you're saying in the last 3 months, I really think that diversity and inclusion is something that we need to take seriously at my company,
yep.
right?
Right?
And I'm going to cut checks and we should do this.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel that in order for you really to care, your compensation should be tied to the metrics that you lay out for your company to get the diversity and inclusion benchmarks.
Yeah.
Right? So your bonus, your salary, however you want to look at it.
Okay. Yeah,
compensation
sure.
at that level
right.
should be a part of that accountability, and you'll start to see some change. It needs to be felt emotionally. Don't
right.
get me wrong.
Sure,
you got to buy in.
Yeah.
You got to want to do it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's all about the money, but ultimately, too, a lot of these companies should be compensation should be a part of that, right?
Yeah.
And then I think what's – and I also think what's happening, and I tend to think that's maybe for the older executive that came through this industry with a lot of systemic issues and now is on the sunset, and you're trying to think, why is that executive on the sunset just now having an epiphany?
Right.
Is the change really going to happen? I do think there's a groundswell of younger executives coming into this industry that do want to make sure that it not only do they want to make sure that the companies that they work for are doing these things, they won't work at companies that don't do these things.
And is there a way to make this accountability public? Is there like a database that could be publicly listed saying, here are the companies? Like, I was looking at the Billboard top 100 power players. The top 10 are all white. The top 50, I think there was only one or two black people.
John Platt.
And right. And there's like four people of color.
Other person,
but that's that
and
was it.
And by the way, it's something. So I go to Billboard Power 100 every year.
Yeah.
And it's talked about in that room.
Yeah.
When I run into the other black executives in that room,
yeah.
we talk about it.
Yeah.
I don't know if all the other white executives realize we're talking about it.
Right.
We talk about it. This is true.
Yeah. Right.
You know, it's really true. And it's not that, hey, Billboard, go pick executives of color so you can have better representation on your list.
Yeah.
It goes deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on at these companies to where where people aren't put into the position to have a shot at being on that list?
Right. I mean, it's like, you can't just say, oh, we're going to exclude Universal because it's run by a white guy. It's like, well, no, Universal is still one of the most powerful music companies, and the person who runs that is going to make the Billboard power list. And so it's like, and same with all the other companies. And so it's just like when you're looking at who's running those companies. And so
that's more hurtful. What's more hurtful to the movement is somebody saying the solution is, let's just not put Lucian in there. Let's just put somebody else in there because they're of color. And we solved it, right?
Yes.
You got to unpack, and the unpacking of it is, well, why is it that there's only these, to your point, white executives that are at the very tops of these companies? You know, on down to, hey, our internship program's not right.
Right, because you don't want to just put a Band-Aid on this bullet wound.
Exactly.
And by just replacing it, it's like, all right, Lucian, sorry, you're gone. We're putting in some black person just so we can, like, check this off.
Mm-hmm.
And then the systemic issues are still maintained throughout the entire ecosystem of the company.
We saw that with busing in schools, right? I went to a school that was desegregated by busing. And you know, from a statistical standpoint, it you can look at it on paper and be like, oh, we solved. We now have 6% of the school population here is of color, right?
Yeah.
Because
we
bus students in. But when you really were in the lunchroom, it wasn't working.
So I'm curious if you think that there could be a way. I mean, internship programs, that's something I hadn't thought of, and that's like a really illuminating and concrete change that people can make, is shifting the internship programs to be paid internships, and then also recruiting outside of your normal recruitment tactics. I'm wondering if it can start in other areas, like in communities, like at universities, or even at the high school level, kind of encouraging or just educating in a way that there can be kind of a mentorship program in some way. Is any of that like explored, or is that something that would be possible?
Not explored enough.
Yeah.
I mean, there should be mentorship programs. There should be, when you're, you know, through these internships, recognizing who are the standouts and who are the ones that we should be carrying into future semesters, summer semesters, or semesters of internships, and then eventually graduating and having two or three mentors through internship programs that now can help place you in the industry.
The pipeline.
We have to actively walk in our practice of breaking systemic issues.
Right.
You have to really think, how is it going to be done, and what are the systems that we're going to set up? And again, cutting checks is fine, but if you're not thinking, how do I invest, take that money and invest in what we do as an organization, you're missing the mark.
So, yeah, absolutely. And I'm curious about, you know, there's been a lot of talk about reparations in society. I mean, I read Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Case for Reparations from The Atlantic that he wrote, gosh, it must have been maybe 5-6 years ago, something like that. That's more about reparations for the entire society, America. I'm wondering if there's a way that that could work within the music industry in terms of just like, it's almost like a reinvestment. It's like, you know, I was, I don't remember what this was from, but like I was learning about, you know, after World War II, after the Holocaust, Germany paid reparations to Israel, to the Jews, and was part of the way because they're like, because they pulled, they felt morally that this was the right move to make, to invest in a community that they not just disenfranchised, but actually completely oppressed, and they paid reparations to Jews in Israel, and that was part of the reason that Israel thrived so rapidly. I'm wondering if there's a way that reparations, if you think it, there's any place for that, if that should be looked at in music at all, and what that would even look like.
It's interesting because your example is a societal,
right?
Versus industry.
Right.
Which is within the industry, you have, you know, we're in America, so we're built on capitalism.
Right.
And this country was built, you know, was built on racism. It just was flat out, right?
Yes.
Starting with the Native Americans. So I almost feel like I think it could work, but it should holistically, it would have to start at a societal level,
okay,
and then trickle down into industry to have wide impact. But that being said, yeah, I mean, how interesting would it be if record label Acmeco, whatever, you know, Acmeco, right, whatever record label, stood up and said, listen, the agreements that we cut with artists in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and in some cases the 80s and 90s were not fair.
Right.
And we are publicly going to say that they were not fair.
Mm-hmm.
And even we're publicly going to say the estates of this artist or that artist, your deals were not fair, and we're going to restructure those.
That would be amazing.
That would be amazing. And it would be a step in the right direction, but it would also be an example of a company saying, recognizing what I talked about earlier, recognizing that they were a part of the problem.
Yes.
Right.
It's that acknowledgement. And that's what's
instead, needed. Instead, a lot of companies would rather say, well, let's not talk about the past. Let's talk about the solutions that we put in place. We now take Juneteenth off. We cut $1 million to Color and Change.
Right.
You know, we posted in solidarity.
Right.
We're not part of the problem.
Yeah.
Progressive privilege.
Right. Right. And that's because it has to affect the bottom line in the business. And that's where the uncomfortable conversations need to happen, and where there's going to be the most amount of pushback is when you're saying, well, we're going to pull from all of your revenue, from your salaries, and from your bottom line, and right the wrongs of the past, of what we have done as an industry. And you start with, I like that, looking at the deals with individual artists. But then even, I mean, because it's the reinvestment. And that was kind of you were mentioning before. That's what, you know, when in society we're exploring that. That's what the Defund the Police movement is all about, is taking money from over here where we're overfunding police right now and investing that into communities, specifically communities of color, to build up the community so that policing is not as needed, because we have social programs that are now supporting. So it's the community supporting itself, but we're taking the money that traditionally has gone into policing those communities and then helping build it up. It's like a different, it's that reinvestment. Reallocation. Exactly. I'm trying to see if there's like some kind of parallel that could work in the music industry, similar to how we're thinking about that, because it's like, you know, it's not just enough of cutting every executive salary and like putting that to the artist's baseline, or like, let's give them a few more points on their record deal or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. And I'm just like, because I think everyone, well, most people acknowledge that there's a systemic issue, and there has been from that pipeline, from the internship program all the way up to the executive level. And all you need to do is look at the Billboard power list to see there's a problem here. But even in every boardroom, like you mentioned, it's very obvious. But then when the charts are dominated by black artists, and it's, you know, it's like black culture is dominating just American pop culture, there's such a imbalance there. And like, I'm I'm at a loss to kind of see what are the steps that, like, on an individual level, because if you're looking at it like systemic level, it's like, okay, there's only how many of the executives can like make those executive decisions saying, all right, we're changing this, we're doing this, this, and this. But like, is there something that individuals in the music industry can do, specifically white individuals, that would just, I don't know, in your opinion, that would help the movement?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, helping mobilize, right? You know, okay. Communication's key. But like I was saying before, it's like, you know, if you're working at a company that's, you know, embracing these kind of practices and not being self-reflective and being progressively privileged about it, high-fiving because you post it on social media and you cut a check, tell me you don't rock with them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's no better time than right now. That's the other thing that's interesting right now, with that this intersection that we hit of COVID and the conversation around race. It came at a time where, you know, you could probably be more vocal than you've ever felt before.
Yeah.
Where you work, especially in our industry.
Yeah.
What are they going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Fire you?
Right. Right.
You're right.
Yeah.
What are they going to do? You know, everyone's vulnerable.
Yeah.
So it's like the perfect time, you know, we're all not touring.
Yeah.
We're mostly home.
Yeah.
We're working from home. We're having these conversations. You know, I think companies are scared to a certain extent. I think that's why you saw so much activity with posting and cutting checks.
Yeah.
Because nobody wanted to get called out.
Right.
But I think that's dangerous. Like I said before, that's the equivalent of putting the Black Lives Matter poster in your window and then going and voting how you vote or hiring how you hire that next day. You know, that's a very facade thing.
Right.
And but if you work at these companies, or you're an executive at these companies, or you're an officer at the companies, yeah, stand up and say, listen, this is not how it should be, and this is the perfect time to do it.
Yeah.
We have a runway between when we're actually going to be all busy again, where it says, you know what, I really think this is important, but we have this immediate short-term need of a tour going up, or, you know, like, we have a runway right now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's, I feel like it's really, yeah, like you said, I mean, it is the perfect time to be having these conversations. And I think that was the biggest challenge before, is like, even if people felt like there was injustice in their company, the lower the totem pole you are, the less empowered you felt to speak out, because it's like, then you're deemed difficult, or you're challenging the status quo, and you don't really have that power to do that. And now people are feeling more empowered. And so, yeah, I mean, hopefully we're going to start to see it's obviously going to be incremental, but, you know, some companies are coming out, like, you know, the distributor STEM, the independent distributor, Milana Rapkin, she's the CEO, and they were one of the very few companies that not just made a Blackout Tuesday show must be paused post, but actually took a couple weeks and looked into the entire structure of their company and said, you know, we failed. We failed at the executive level. We failed in our hiring practices. And they put out like a step-by-step plan of how they were going to be more inclusive and active in their hiring practices and just like focusing on that. And you know, it was nice to see that they're willing to take those concrete steps and not just kind of move on businesses as usual, you know, a few weeks after the noise has kind of died down.
Yeah, and I wasn't aware of that, and I applaud her for taking that action, because I always say that these things are much easier to talk about now than when there's a crisis.
Right.
And crises have come to life now when you get called out or somebody says, you know, there was a Los Angeles Times article about a week ago. I don't know if you saw it, and I can't remember the company that this woman worked at, but the title of the article was entertainment company says they believe in the Black Lives Matter movement. Former employee thinks different.
Former
Black employee
that.
Thinks
right.
different.
I did see that. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So exactly. When it becomes a crisis, because somebody says
yeah,
you know, I'm gonna publicly talk about the things that you were doing as a company, right? Then it's like, oh, let's rush and get something out. We're gonna fix this, right?
Yeah.
Be proactive about it.
Yes. And not just wait to get called out.
Don't wait till it's a crisis.
Yeah.
It's much more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm concerned similarly that like, as we've all been seeing, you know, right when the protests started after George Floyd, everyone's very active. There's 100,000 people on Hollywood Boulevard protesting. And, you know, you attend the protest and it gets fewer and fewer people. People are talking about it less and less on social media. And then it's going to kind of get into kind of business as usual again. Are you noticing kind of people losing interest? And if so, I mean, even with the Black Music Coalition, is this something that is going to kind of keep those companies held accountable in a way that's ongoing and to have the regular check-ins? And
hopefully you get to one day where it's not needed.
Right.
You know, and that, you know, that's been worked on for decades.
Right.
Multiple civil rights leaders, and you get better and better, right?
Yeah.
We do have progress in society. So something's happening at a societal level.
Yeah.
And yes, distractions exist.
Yeah.
You know, be it the COVID, you know, resurge, or be it Kanye 2020, distractions will be out there. Right. So you have to stay focused and keep pushing it into the forefront and making sure it's at the top of conversation. Mm-hmm. And only time will tell this time next year when we're all kind of hopefully comfortably starting to get back into a normalcy around industry things, whether or not we're pushing it forward and addressing it. I hope that executives at all different levels feel that they can bring it up and talk about it without risking their jobs.
Yeah.
You know, real talk, right?
Yep.
You know, risking confrontation.
Yeah.
They can bring these things up and they can be talked about.
Yeah.
Once things come back on board. And I feel that's going to happen. I really, really do. I feel that's going to happen.
Yeah. I hope so. And I think it's, you know, we want to look at this as not just a moment, but actually a way that can be integrated into the
fabric of everyday. Yeah,
absolutely. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah. And I think a lot of us, like white allies, have been kind of just trying to figure out how do we help, like, amplify the Black leaders and their voices and just try to be like supporters of this movement and like integrate this into our daily lives and, you know, just help keep the momentum going so it doesn't just die out. Because I mean, I fully acknowledge that it's very easy for me to just kind of pretend this doesn't exist because I'm not forced with acknowledging it on a daily basis. But now it's, you know, now that like the wool has been pulled over, you know, away from my eyes, I'm like, oh, now I don't feel comfortable not acknowledging it on a regular basis. And like, I'm just trying to find ways to just like help, you know, move this movement forward effectively.
Yeah, and then on my end, as a person of color,
yeah,
it's not pretending that that didn't hurt what somebody said, right?
Right.
It's not you know, pretending that that didn't make me fearful.
Yeah.
What somebody said or did, right?
Yeah.
And that's the part that we in our society, but in our industry, need to push forward on. Exactly what you just said, exactly what I said. We have to get comfortable with that.
Yeah.
And I when I look back at my career and I look at things that times that I felt hurt or uncomfortable because somebody said something or did something,
yeah,
and I didn't say anything about it, I do look at myself as much as I look at them, that what could have been done better in that situation.
Yeah, sure. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's, this is like the reckoning that I think society needed to have, but also our industry has needed to have for a long time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, well, that's great. And I appreciate kind of, you know, being able to have this conversation, because it's something that, like, I think for so long people weren't having at, white people weren't having, like, you know, like you were saying, when you're in the room with the Billboard Power 100 and it's like, it's just a few black people, and it's like you're having those conversations, but none of the white people are having them. So you do have an all black roster. Now, was that intentional when you're kind of signing artists? Was that part of the Culture Collective mission statement to amplify artists of color? Or is this something that it's kind of just in your personal taste, or how that all works?
I think it's definitely part of the mission statement of the company. But okay. The reality is, I was, before I started Culture Collective, I'd worked primarily, you know, with black artists that fell under my responsibility at Red Light. Of course, I worked with everybody.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, the mission statement of the company is to embrace those that are. You know, using music as a channel to express their culture. I think it's important, and I've always thought it was important, that artists of color have the opportunity to sit across the table from a manager that looks like them.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it has to be that way.
Sure.
But they should have the opportunity for it to be that way.
Mm.
And that is what was missing at a lot of these big box management companies.
Okay. Yeah.
And again, I'm not saying those companies were doing it intentionally.
Right.
Right. I think they were very much doing it unintentionally.
Right.
But it goes back to, what are the practices that those companies are doing to fix that issue?
Sure.
And, you know, when I started Culture Collective, it wasn't that I couldn't have done Culture Collective at another company and said, let's do this together. It was important for me to do it, one, because it would be my narrative, but also it was important for me, for young executives, to say that somebody could do it. You can start your own company. You can leave working at premier companies and go do your own thing.
Yeah.
And do it in a way that's respected and professionalized and well put together. You know, it can happen. You can do it.
Yeah.
And I honestly think, in this post-COVID world,
yeah,
holistically, we're going to see more independent boutique companies, especially in management.
So that's interesting. That's something that a lot of people are kind of thinking about, what is going to shift from post-COVID. Why do you think that? Why do you think that we're going to the boutique agencies will start up and like the big box management companies won't?
I think it's gonna happen in management. I think it's gonna happen in a lot of different industries, including outside of music, because I think, sure, what you're having right now is there is an element of too small to fail from a governmental standpoint.
Okay.
Right. Well, 2008 was too big to fail.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
when Bear Stearns went under and AIG. And then this administration has really used this crisis as an opportunity to make sure that the small business owner is taken care of in a way that their business can thrive. And I'm not saying it's by any means remotely perfect,
right?
Because we don't know what we're dealing with,
right?
But there is an element of, let's make sure that these smaller businesses are taken care of. So, but in order to take advantage of those situations, you really have to have structure around your business and what you do. But the when you are a business owner during a situation like this, you know how much money's coming in. You know how much money's coming out. You know how you can lower your expenses. Mm-hmm. It's your business. You know, you can work directly with your bank in setting up these programs to help save your business.
Right.
If you're working for somebody else, right?
Yeah.
You're hoping they get it right.
Yeah, right.
You're hoping they get it right, right?
Yep.
And when you're working for a service-based company, not like a product-based company like, you know, Spotify, mm-hmm. right? We're working for like we, you know, service base. You're really, really hoping they get it right because it trickles down, right? You know, that essentially that company is your partner in your business. So you're hoping that your partner gets it right. And I feel like the more control you have over your business, the more you can make sure it's done right. And I think that coming into a post-COVID world, a lot of it was already happening before the whole gig economy and the ability for you to start your own company,
right.
and hang your own shingle and have your own logo and have your own brand, you know,
yeah.
you know, was a thing. The one thing that was missing there with a lot of people was like, well, I don't want to take the financial risk. Or I don't want to take the business risk. Or I don't want to learn how to do the accounting and all that stuff. I don't want to do any of those things. I want someone just to do it for me and let me know every quarter, every year where I land.
Yep.
But now you go through something like this and you're like, boy, I hope they make the right decisions on my behalf because now my business is going to be impacted by the decisions that they make.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that you'll see that shift. It's a much more of boutique-y type businesses where someone says, hey, this is my business. And maybe I've partnered with other managers, you know, to do some best, some shared services, but ultimately it's my business.
Well, I mean, this just the whole new industry has enabled kind of the independence to thrive. I mean, we've seen that, you know, just at every level, but it's like traditionally, even on, you know, you needed the major record label system, even just for distribution to move physical product. It was like those pipelines and those channels is what existed before. And now that's why so many independent artists are thriving is because you don't need the whole expensive infrastructure to get your music out to the public. You just need an internet connection, basically. And so, I mean, I think we are seeing, you know, kind of smaller boutique-y at every level from distribution to independent artists to indie label to managers to all of that. Every level is thriving in that smaller way. So, well, yeah, I mean, it's a great time. So for your artists right now, I mean, I to kind of bring it back around to the artists, like, you know, Emily King, she was nominated for a Grammy this last year.
Two Grammys this last year.
Right. And it was, I mean, was that the first time that you worked with, like that kind of, I guess, well, with Culture Collective, that was your first couple of Grammy nominations.
It was our first couple of Grammy nominations. We had Leon Thomas, who's a client, was nominated for production on Rick Ross and Drake's record, Gold Roses.
Okay.
But yeah, it was great. I mean, listen, to that literally almost a year because the Grammys were in February, so a year to launch.
Yeah,
we had two Grammy nominations with an artist that we worked with for a long time that was super supportive in the launch of Culture Collective. You know, and you know, listen, much love to the clients that I work with that were, you know, that understood the vision that I had and started the company and that were willing to come with me.
Right.
And be a part of it.
I mean, that's a leap of faith for everyone is because it's like leaving this institution that has, you know, seemingly this infrastructure that can support what they're doing to kind of jump with you into this whole new realm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I think it's a testament too of artists wanting to, you know, they believed in what I was doing. And that was driving their decision, the belief in what my vision was.
Yeah.
Right.
Cool.
And I think that's going to, and I spoke about that before, I think that's going to manifest itself in this younger generation where it's not just about working at a company to help build the resume. Those companies have to represent the values of what they believe in as individuals. And I think you'll see that on the artist level too.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Right on. Well, Jonathan Azu, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was really great.
This episode
episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com.